Hi, I'm Angie Hicks, co-founder of Angie, and one thing I've learned is that you buy a house, but you make it a home. Because with every fix, update, and renovation, it becomes a little more your own. So you need all your jobs done well. For nearly 30 years, Angie has helped millions of homeowners hire skilled pros for the projects that matter, from plumbing to electrical, roof repair to deck upgrades. So leave it to the pros who will get your jobs done well.
Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find a pro for your project at Angie.com.
Any team that's tested AI tools for data has seen the pattern already. AI gives a different number than your BI tool. Metrics don't match across teams. And inevitably, users lose trust. It turns out, turning on AI is easy, but making it work on data is not. Hex AI was built to solve this. The key is nailing context. Hex is built to unify and curate your data context for agents. Data teams can observe, govern, and continuously improve every AI answer, so answers get smarter the more your team asks. The result? Your entire organization asks data questions in natural language and trusts the answers. Not because the AI got lucky, because it knows your business and its data. Because that's what an AI analytics platform should do. Join data teams from Cursor, Lovable, Ramp, AWS, and over 2,000 more at hex.ai.
This week on Lunchbox Envy, Nell Gwynn, the infamous mistress of Charles II, used to sell them at the theatre.
It takes 50 glasses of water to produce a single glass of juice.
And when they fall off the trees in Seville, they're used as fuel for the city's power plants.
It's oranges! Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Rosie, I'm a chef and food writer, and I'm here with QI elves Jack and Manu. Hello guys.
Hey Rosie, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Very excited for this one.
Yeah, and we haven't really touched too much on all of the different fruits.
Well, we will.
Mainly because they're not bloody fruits, as it turns out. Tell me this is a fruit.
No, this one is a fruit.
A modified berry.
There we go.
Also called a Hesperidium.
Hesperidium.
I love that word.
Sounds like a posh girls' school lacrosse player.
Yeah, it does actually.
Possible to Hesper. So if you cut an orange in half, imagine it like your geography lessons, you're looking at the Earth's core. So the middle bit, basically 90% of the orange, the flesh, is the carpel or carpels. And then the small rim around the outside, which we call the pith, which is white coloured, is the albedo.
Oh, I'm going to add that to my boy's name list for next time.
And then the even thinner orange part of the rind, the outside bit, is the flavedo.
So that's the like the skin.
The oily orange bit.
Yeah, that's got all the oils in it, hasn't it? Do you have any information on the sort of pimpliness of an orange's skin?
Well, they do actually create, they're like pores on human skin. That's where the oil comes from. They're called oil vesicles.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that explains why really wanky cocktail bars will like twist the
torture,
orange peel. And actually, if you do see a close-up slow-mo filming thing, you can see the oil spraying out.
I was going to say, it's one of my favourite things, like all of the psh.
Yeah.
So stunning.
My fondest orange memories, I'm sure many British children everywhere feel the same way, are, of course, at halftime.
Half-time.
During a game of whatever sport you might have played at school.
Yeah, what was your sport?
Hockey.
Hockey.
That's right. I was a real goal hanger. I used to be left wing. I just stand in the goal, just sweeping in. Anyway, oranges at halftime was like, for some reason, what they brought you to give you energy. Even though I actually don't think they are that quick working. They've obviously got sugar in.
Yeah, but... and lots of liquid. They're refreshing.
No.
But that was always a trait, but I don't think I ever had oranges, personally.
I mean, I didn't go to school, so I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
I forget. I'm with the two.
Manny had to forage her own oranges.
Out in the grove. One thing I do remember from eating oranges as a kid, which is still one of the best things to do, you know, when you eat a slice and then you leave the slice in your mouth in front of your teeth.
Dentists everywhere are like, that is terrible to do.
Useful as a hockey mouth guard, though.
Well, that's what everyone would do.
Really?
All your mates would turn around and be like, hello. And you'd have the orange grin. And it didn't matter if he hadn't scored 4 goals that quarter, like I had.
Where are oranges from?
So for ages, we weren't entirely sure. We knew they were from South or East Asia. Mm. But in 2023, researchers studying citrus genomics found that the original citrus fruit, so not just oranges, but like the whole family, because they've got like a wild, sexy genetic history, evolved.
If you find inbreeding sexy, yeah.
They evolved from a fruit in India.
Okay.
That's actually super recent. 2023.
Yeah,
to find
yeah,
that
it's
out.
Really recent. Yeah.
2 years.
Breaking news.
But like I think we mentioned in the lemons episode, the citrus kind of family tree comes back to these three original fruits, the OG three, citron, pomelo, mandarin.
Oh.
And then all of their kids are really sexually compatible. So if they like change a little bit down the family tree, like their nephew and their like great niece can still have sex and make new fruits. And the reason why we have so many different kinds of citrus and they're one of the most widely cultivated fruits is because they can naturally procreate
with each other.
Yeah, and produce all of these mad varieties. And just like apples with the grafting, if you grow one from seed, you're going to have a completely different fruit.
That's true.
So that is why you graft.
And in fact, there's no such thing as an orange in the wild. Common citruses like limes, lemons, oranges, grapefruits, they're all hybrids. Grapefruit is a mix between a pomelo and a sweet orange. And then a sweet orange is a mix of a mandarin and a bitter orange. And the bitter orange is a mix of a mandarin and a pomelo. So it's all very intertwined. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole complex family tree.
So, yeah, after all of this amazing kind of natural change in breeding and also human selection, we've come out with the common sweet orange.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm. Which is probably the one that's in front of us right
now. It is indeed. Yeah. I think that's mostly what we're going to talk about. Mm. It's funny that the original natural citrus fruit we don't really see, like pomelos, we'll all have seen one, but they're not in the shops.
The original fruits are often like really, really bitter and really hard to work with, like really hard to peel. The flesh is like quite different. If you've ever had a kind of unripe grapefruit, that's the kind of thing we're dealing with.
Not very functionally appealing.
What appealing?
Hey!
One of the things I found out recently, which I love, is this group of researchers at the Agricultural Sciences Center in Chongqing in China. So they were ranking the kind of peelability and accessibility of different citrus fruits. And so they found that the ones with the skins that stuck most to the fruit were pomelos, and then it was lemons and oranges and mandarins in descending order.
Okay.
And then the ease of peeling, so the peel resistance to penetration, lemon was the hardest to get into, and mandarins were the easiest to get into.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I've never tried to peel a lemon with my hand, but that must be really hard.
Really tricky. So that's the thing, like nature has given us easy peeled fruits, which I love. It's the same with seedless varieties as well. Yeah. Like that's something that occurs naturally. That's not just us breeding the seeds out of them.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Basically, nature hands us a gift. It produces this like once in a lifetime kind of variety of seedless fruit.
Mm.
And it's basically when there's a pollination failure, but these trees still manage to produce fruit, which is a process called parthenocarpy. And we just need to go out and discover it and then graft it and make sure nothing ever changes ever again. Which is whilst we're talking about engineering really funky citrus fruits. Did you know citrus fruits are dying?
No.
Yeah, there's a bacterial infection spread by insects called huanglongbing, which is killing a lot of citrus groves, but this insect doesn't like the cold. So they're trying to find ways to grow citrus fruits in colder climates. Because at the moment, the only ones that can are super, super bitter and inedible and gross.
Okay. Mm.
So they're using CRISPR, like the gene editing technology, to create varieties that can survive in the cold, but still retain their sweetness.
On that, I would say it was a particularly bad year for clementines and mandarins, easy peelings of those from the supermarkets. You guys, I have a medical addiction to clementines at Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
They will be the only thing I eat all afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And I found the crop this year to be, this past year, sorry, 2025 Christmas, to be particularly disappointing.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know if there's a reason for that. Maybe I just was buying them from the wrong place, but my God, I was devastated.
Do you guys know the difference between mandarins, clementines, satsumas, yeah, easy peelers, tangerines?
I have researched this and I do not know still.
I won't say it very much, but educate me.
I will. Well, there's not a very simple answer other than they're all just named after the places they come from.
Okay.
So they're all various different crosses. So the clementine is a cross between a mandarin and a sweet orange. And it's named after a French missionary called Clément Rodier. And I find it nice that he's buried near Oran in Algeria, which is almost orange. And then easy peelers are also a variety of mandarin, usually hybrids of clementines and mandarins.
Named after the town, easy peeler.
Tangerines are a variant of the mandarin, so named because they're imported into Europe via Tangiers in Morocco.
Ah.
A satsuma. A Japanese variant of the mandarin. They're all basically variants of mandarins and sweet oranges.
Right.
But that was also same named because it came from the Japanese port of Satsuma.
Ah.
Valencia oranges. Where are they from?
Oh, I'm scared.
They're from California.
What? I was going to say they were Valencia.
No, well, ironically, Valencia is full of oranges, but they're all bitter oranges.
Yes. Famously, if you've ever seen a tourists film a TikTok of themselves picking an orange in Seville or Valencia and then trying to eat it, they are not good.
Amazing.
That is not a worthwhile thing to do.
Hi, I'm Angie Hicks, co-founder of Angie. When you use Angie for your home projects, you know all your jobs will be done well. Roof repair? Done well. Kitchen sink install? Done well. Deck upgrades? Done well. Electrical upgrade? Done well. Angie's been connecting homeowners with skilled pros for nearly 30 years, so we know the difference between done and done well. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find a pro for your project at Angie.com.
Any team that's tested AI tools for data has seen the pattern already. AI gives a different number than your BI tool. Metrics don't match across teams, and inevitably, users lose trust. It turns out, turning on AI is easy, but making it work on data is not. Hex AI was built to solve this. The key is nailing context. Hex is built to unify and curate your data context for agents. Data teams can observe, govern, and continuously improve every AI answer, so answers get smarter the more your team asks. The result? Your entire organization asks data questions in natural language and trusts the answers. Not because the AI got lucky, because it knows your business and its data. Because that's what an AI analytics platform should do. Join data teams from Cursor, Lovable, Ramp, AWS, and over 2,000 more at hex.ai.
Let's kick off with our first lunchbox, and that's you, Jack.
Okay, this week, I hope you're hungry, I've brought you each a piece of spearmint chewing gum.
Oh, great.
And to allay your concerns as to whether I've gone mad or not, the flavouring from this has come from an orange.
Ah.
Now, let me explain. I want to talk to you about fruit juice, and specifically orange juice. So about 50% of the world's citrus produced is orange. And 80% of the world's oranges are turned into juice.
Wow.
I don't think there's any other fruit that you would juice so much of.
It is definitely the most juiced.
I think so. US juice consumption, interestingly, is down 50% on 25 years ago because it used to be seen as quite a healthy thing. And now it's got a bit more of a...
It's got a bad rep.
Bad reputation for being incredibly sugary and bad for your teeth. But anyway.
Is it?
Is it?
Well, I've been telling myself that was one of my five a day.
Sorry.
Nothing is sacred. Every time I come on here, I learn something more depressing about the food I love.
So when you sell an orange in the shop, you're obviously selling the whole thing, you know? But the processing of making juice means you have to slice the orange in half, squeeze the juice out, and then you're left with the dry, sort of slimy peel. And obviously, industry want to try and make a profit off this waste material. And so they can do multiple things. You can make bioplastics out of it, or textiles, or yarn. I saw a brilliant Italian company that were making bioplastics and yarn and textiles from it.
You can also, orange fiber.
orange fibre.
And they collaborated with Salvatore Ferragamo.
Did they?
Who is yeah. that?
A very famous Italian designer. And they made a shirt or something. I don't know.
They made a shirt or something. Nice. I don't know. There's also a way to extract the precious metals from lithium batteries that have passed it by using crushed orange peel powder and citric acid to extract the minerals back.
Wow. Yeah. That's so cool. Clever that they figured that out.
I know. It's quite an innovative technique. They're sort of refining it as we speak. You can also extract pectin from the pith. Mm-hmm. And you can use that in jams for fruits that don't have much pectin, because pectin is the stuff that makes jams jelly-like, like
yeah,
solid.
It's a polysaccharide, okay. A type of naturally occurring fiber in the cell walls of fruit. And it is literally a gelling agent when it is heated with acid and sugar. So it's like essential for marmalade and jam and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
But a lot of fruits don't naturally have pectin, so you have to add it back.
You'd add citrus, or you'd add the pectin product.
They often put the ground up pith into chicken feed.
Oh, do they?
So you get kind of, that's, I don't know if it worked, but like pre-internally marinated chicken. But anyway, one final thing you can do is you can extract the orange oil. Orange oil is useful in many different perfumes and solvents and things that you clean the house with. Mm. And what you're actually trying to get is the essential oil called limonene. Mm. I want to talk about limonene for a bit. So basically, limonene is a chiral molecule. To get a bit chemical here, chirality...
We did talk about this once.
Have we?
But I can't remember in what context or for what episode, so remind me.
So these are molecules that are made up of the same... atoms, and they've got almost the same structure, but because of the way they're arranged, they actually behave very differently. Chiral, have you seen diagrams of molecules that have like a hexagon and like an H here and an O there, and lots of like arms and legs coming off? They are sometimes an easy way to visualize it is always illustrated with hands. So our hands are chiral. We have four fingers and a thumb on each hand. Chemical formula for a hand is 4 × finger, 1 × thumb, right? And that's the same for both hands. But the thumb is on different sides and they're in a different order. So your little fingers are on the outside always. There are different versions of chirality because there are multiple planes you can tweak the hydrogen atoms and blah, blah, blah. For the ease of discussion, we'll talk about left-handed and right-handed molecules. And when it comes to food, chirality is incredibly useful for tweaking different flavors and creating new flavors out of things that you have. So that's the same for limonene, D-limonene, I think, for dexter, the Latin for right. And L-limonene is the other way around. And they have different properties. If you add an oxygen atom to limonene and take away two hydrogens, you get something called carvone.
Right.
And carvone is another chiral molecule. Left-handed carvone smells like caraway seeds.
Ooh.
And it's used in, you know, candles and cleaning products that want to smell like caraway seeds or dill. And then when you get the enantiomer, right-handed carvone smells like spearmint flavor. Because it's so much more expensive to squash down actual mint to get the mint flavor, most cheap industrialized mint-flavored products will contain carvone. And you get carvone from limonene. Where'd you get limonene from? The orange peel!
Oh, shit!
That's so good.
That was actually... It's really interesting because I was reflecting on what about cooked orange flavour is it that I sometimes don't like? And it is that it is a bit minty.
Really? Yeah.
Like it's very like strongly, it's so strongly perfumed that it can come onto the palate as menthol, basically. So interesting.
Well, if you get the left-handed limonene, it smells a bit more piney, which is why you can sort of see the missing link. And I do you ever go to the continent, particularly France, and they sell like eucalyptus flavored chewing gum?
Oh, so good.
Yeah, but to me that just smells of toilet cleaner.
I am addicted to eucalyptus chewing gum.
I have never ever tried it.
So another chiral molecule that we consume is glucose. If you get the right-handed version of glucose, D-glucose, that is something our body can metabolize. But if you switch it to the left-handed version, known as L-glucose, that just goes straight through us. They both taste the same on our tongue. So when you're making an artificial sweetener, they just tweak the molecule to make it a version of left-handed glucose, and then it's calorie-free. It goes right through us. Our body can't metabolize it.
So clever.
Genius idea.
Yeah.
Why don't they taste the same then?
They don't taste identical, but that's because our tongue receptors are receptive to chirality.
This reminds me quite a lot of when we chatted about strawberry flavour and how so much of natural flavourings are made from things that are not anything to do with the flavor that they're making. So like wood is used to make the vanilla flavor, and it's called a natural flavoring because it's made from wood. It's actually not a vegetable
thing.
Well,
this is so probably the same. I suspect it says on my pack of gum and natural flavorings, and it may well be from orange peel and they get the mint.
One slightly less joyous story about chirality and molecules was the thalidomide scandal. Early 60s, when women were given an anti-morning sickness drug, which created a lot of physical deformities in their babies. And that was because in the synthesis of the drug, they'd created the flipped version of that molecule. And apparently, if they'd just done it properly, it would have been one of the most effective, incredible morning sickness drugs ever. But because of this mistake, obviously people stopped taking it, and it was banned, never.
So there are two forms of orange juice you may have seen in the shops, concentrate and not from concentrate.
I think it's one of those things that is really confusing to kids, because obviously juice is such a big like part of a kid's diet. And then you read the words not from concentrate and you're like, eh? Concentrate? Well, what are you talking about?
Well, listen up, kids. I'll explain it for you. Concentrated orange juice, which is invented for the Second World War in America. So the reason you would want concentrate is because A, there's less weight, and it's a way to reduce the shipping cost, and B, it lasts longer because the water in the juice is where the microbes like to live. So they freshly squeeze it in the factory. All orange juice ultimately comes from oranges, but then they have to remove the water through vacuum evaporation. So you basically reduce the pressure in a big chamber such to the point that all the liquid evaporates, and you end up with this sort of syrupy, very transportable and easy to freeze concentrate. And then you just have to add the water back and you'll get orange juice. When it's not from concentrate, that's when it's basically freshly squeezed. They might add a couple of preservatives in there, but like depends on the brand and where you're getting it from. But it basically hasn't ever been reduced to its concentrated form.
Can I ask a personal question?
Please.
Bits or no bits?
Oh, bits.
Bits every time.
The same people who drink no bits are eating smooth peanut butter, and that is
Just to be clear, we're all on the same crunchy peanut butter.
It is mad that that minty flavor comes from oranges.
I know, right?
Because famously, oranges and mint do not go together. If you brush your teeth in the morning and then you eat an orange, it is the worst flavour. Like, why does that happen?
Well, I don't think it's to do with the mint. I read the Colgate website and they said it's because of the surfactant, which is as common in most toothpaste, called sodium lauryl sulfate. And that makes it foamy. But anyway, it has the side effect of blocking receptors in your mouth that detect sweet and bitter. So when you eat something particularly sweet and bitter, you're only getting all the other bits. And there's like tiny trace amounts of salt and calcium and stuff. Basically, the taste is incredibly unbalanced.
I argue with my husband about this quite a lot. Like, I don't brush my teeth before I eat my breakfast because I want to taste my breakfast without the taste of toothpaste.
Whereas heart surgeon would be very angry with you.
Really?
Oh, God.
Apparently your dental plaque, if you don't brush your teeth before you eat breakfast in the morning, can mess with your cardiovascular health.
That's interesting that it's to do with the order you do it in.
I think, yeah, but when you have lots of plaque, I think if you digest that plaque, then it's bad for your heart.
What about the 18 grams of salt that I eat every day? It's got a few things to be angry with me about, I'll tell you that. Let's have a look at our second lunchbox, and that's from you, Manu.
Okay, so today I have brought everyone a carrot.
Oh, Manu, you've done it again.
I don't understand. That's not what we're talking about.
The reason I brought a carrot is because I feel like this is a fantastically orange-coloured food. But the fruit gets all of the glory and all of the fun. And today I wanted to look at weird distinctions in history behind the fruit and the colour and the name and like how all of these things came together and why the orange food fruit has become so synonymous with the colour and how that history came about.
And which came first?
So we'll start with the fact that the fruit came before the colour. Etymologically, the word orange comes from the Arabic naranj, which comes from the Persian narang, which comes from the Sanskrit narangas, which is orange tree.
Ah, okay.
So before oranges arrived in Europe in around the 14th century, we used to call orange coloured things red yellow or yellowy red or saffron.
Okay.
Because we already had saffron.
Now, I find this a great philosophical question because orange was one of the last colours we've come up with in English. And it's not just like nothing was orange before we had a word. Although there were very few naturally occurring orange plants, actually, in this country. Get a lot of yellows and a lot of reds, but nothing in between.
Yeah.
But just like conceptually, because I remember reading that in Russian, they have two different words for blue, and one of them is what we would say is light blue and the other one is dark blue, but they're etymologically unrelated, so they see them as two separate colors because the color spectrum's not divided at all, like it's a spectrum. And in fact, I think Isaac Newton found six colors, but he thought seven was so much more auspicious that he split purple into indigo and violet. So presumably before we just had the word for orange, we would see things as very dark yellow or very light red.
As the fruit becomes more popular, say by the 16th century, it's widespread enough that, say, Shakespeare's making orange puns. One of his plays, Much Ado About Nothing,
he says, any good. <Go on.
laughs> civil as an orange. But
I must have missed that one. I didn't.
So it's Seville orange.
You should have 15 minutes on Live at the Apollo for that. That's good. Actually quite good.
Yeah. Orange, you glad you decided to do this podcast?
So oranges become like the orange fruit.
Did you know that an orange used to be a norange? It used to begin with an N.
A
norange. And then it got confused, and now we say an orange.
Because
of naranj. Because of naranj. And all these other languages, naranja, which is the opposite of newt. That used to be an ute. And then that got confused the other way, and now it's a newt.
Do you remember when you were little being told that there was no word that rhymes with orange?
It's not true.
It is not true.
What is the word that does rhyme with it?
Quite a few.
Yeah. There are a number of people with the surname, I know this doesn't count, but Gorringe.
Gorringe.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a sporange, which is part of the plant that produces spores.
And then there's a blorange.
Blorange. Is that like a blowjob with an orange?
Blorange is a hill just outside of Abu Ghibeni.
Oh, another proper noun.
So, yes, sure. All of these words rhyme with orange. Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't use them in common parlance.
So to round everything off, we have the fruit, we name the fruit, and then we use that name and assign it to the colour.
Wow, so influential, the orange.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
No other fruit has done that.
There's another food which is famously super orange, which is the carrot that I want to talk to you about today, because there's a story about how carrots became orange. Carrots originally purple and
what?
Yeah.
Yes. So they're like
oh my god.
Usually in the wild they're and white and yellow, all sorts of colours. Many of them are purple. There's a story about how Dutch farmers started breeding orange carrots to honor William of Orange, who is one of the people who kind of brought an independent Netherlands, because the Netherlands used to be a Spanish colony, which is a fantastic story, but unfortunately there's no evidence that it's true, because orange carrots existed in Spain like quite a few centuries before they started breeding them in the Netherlands. And even William of Orange, like the House of Orange, this orange, very, very orange family.
Still in charge today.
Yes. even their name doesn't come from the fruit or the colour.
It's a French town. There's still a French town, which is called Orange, and it's spelt the same. And that is named after the Celtic.
So the Celtic water god, Rocio.
Yeah, which literally means in front of the ear.
In front of the ear?
Yeah.
Oh. But like, even today, the Dutch really have got orange as their colour.
Yeah, it's such a convenient marketing thing that they happen to have like had this, you know, dynasty that came from a part of the world that was named sort of like a colour.
Yeah, no, the Dutch are still very, like you said, obsessed with orange. So on King's Day, which is to celebrate the King's birthday, which is for this King, the 27th of April, everyone dresses in orange. Everyone gets really, really pissed. They play games like bite the cake, which is when you hang a cake from a string and you bite it blindfolded, and throw the toilet bowl, which is throwing a toilet bowl really, really far.
Toilet bowl?
Yeah, like the whole thing. Yeah, the whole thing.
Not sure I can pick one up.
The King of the Netherlands got in trouble with the Telegraph recently for playing that game because it was a bit silly. Anyway, so the Netherlands are just very, very pro-orange, and it is a great football kit. I will give them that.
True.
Another country that is obsessed with oranges, Italy, particularly a town called Ivrea. They have the annual Battle of the Oranges.
Cool.
Which is actually very, very violent. Like, if you look at pictures of it, people are covered in blood. They've got black eyes.
Wow.
A lot of broken noses.
Yeah, and there was definitely some chat on some Reddit. So I did a bit of research on this as well, about how there's rivalry between the Battle of the Oranges in Ivrea and the Tomatina in Valencia. Because they're like, which one is the biggest food-throwing festival? Is it Tomatina? Is it the Battle of the Oranges?
Tomatina is the same with tomatoes, is it?
It's exactly. Yeah. Well, it's not exactly the same because, I don't know, Manu, tell us about the Battle of the Oranges.
So this is around the kind of Shrove celebration time. So just before Lent, there's a festival.
Carnival.
Yeah, exactly. It's a carnival. People get many, many, many oranges. So about 900 tons of oranges each festival. And they lob them at each other. And there are different teams and outfits and people dressed as knights.
They are called in Italian arancieri, which means the orange fighters.
And no one's entirely sure how this festival started. So there's a story that it was kind of as an expression of joy after they banished a kind of despotic leader from the town. In the 1400s, there was someone called the Marquis Ranieri di Biandrate. Anyway, so he was a really, really bad dude. He used to steal just married brides and have his way with them. And everyone was very angry about this man. Until one bride he tried to have sex with killed him and took his severed head to the balcony. And everyone got very excited. And one of the ways they decided to celebrate was to just throw so many oranges at each other.
Interesting.
Is one of the origin stories.
I read that it was initially beans that they used to throw at each other. And then it turned into oranges.
They're a little less painful.
In the mid-1800s, because people decided to weaponize oranges. Because apparently there was a local tradition where girls on balconies would throw oranges at boys that they liked.
Okay.
And then it came about that they were actually a really good weapon. And
they started throwing them at boys they didn't like.
Yeah. And now it is this massive waste of oranges. Let's be honest, guys. It's a fucking waste.
Yeah, it's not great.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. It would really hurt to be hit in the face by an orange. Like, you would cry. I would cry.
Yeah.
Are they full navel oranges or are they like...
I think they store up the oranges well in advance. Obviously you can't just like that get hold of 900 tons of oranges. Mm-hmm. So they've got a store going. And so there are some that are more on the rotten side to begin with. But then they end up having to use fresher and fresher oranges as the battle goes on. And it lasts for 3 days, to be clear. Like 3 days of hours and hours of pelting each other with oranges.
Mm-hmm. Don't these guys have jobs?
No, but also it's really savage because the teams are called things like the Devils, the Mercenaries, the Black Panthers, death.
Yeah, death.
Wow. Just death.
Death.
Like, they are not doing it in a friendly way.
Wow. Mm,
and they all get really, really drunk beforehand. Mm. There's a drink I read about in the article. It's like eggnog. It's kind of warm.
Yeah, oh my God. Advocat. It's so Bombardino.
Yes. Apparently, so everyone's drinking that and then going and pelting each other with oranges.
Ivrea is in Piemonte, and Piemonte is in the northwest of Italy. And a Bombardino is basically an eggnog based drink, and it's custard and liqueur essentially, and it's heaven. Oh, it's heaven. Wow. Guys, it's heaven. But it's like going to give you the worst hangover of your life because it's so sweet and it's very alcoholic.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was the battle of the oranges.
Sounds great. Well, speaking of kings and oranges, Richard the Lionheart spent the winter in 1191 /2. He spent it in Israel, what is now Israel, in the orange groves at Jaffa, which is why the British are quite so fond of Jaffa oranges. Mm. And that's why in 1927, the original cakes, Jaffa cakes, were so named, because they're made with Jaffa oranges.
One of the best things that anyone's made with oranges is a Jaffa cake, I'm going to say.
And another king who was obsessed with oranges is Louis XIV, the Sun King. He had the orangery of the Palace of Versailles built before the palace even started work.
Oh, wow.
Because oranges were so heavily prized. Orangeries are, it's like a greenhouse, so you can artificially create the conditions in which oranges grow, and they're found in lots of country houses, enormous, you know, piles around England and the rest of Europe. They're not always used for oranges now, but...
quite a lot of weddings that have the orangery of XXX
or
place.
National Trust cafes.
Yes, yes.
And he grew allergic to sniffing flowers. So he had to settle.
He overdid it that much.
He overdid it. Because he was obsessed with perfumery, he would just, the only thing he was allowed was citrus oils. And he apparently stuffed his pillowcases with orange leaves. And he would go around spraying the palace with orange oil with his solid silver syringe, which actually I looked into. And he would use a syringe to give himself multiple enemas per day.
I knew you were going to say enemas.
And so he was probably squirting some orange juice up his bum.
And a classic orange juice enema.
Yeah, exactly.
But surely you'd go nose blind to this. If everything smells like oranges, he would not be able to smell it.
I don't know. I think the issue was like the palace was pretty stinky anyway. So he's probably covering up all the other horrible smells. not helped by his enemas.
Why are people obsessed with enemas back then? Jesus Christ. I actually would like to shout out orange blossom.
Oh, yes.
That is one of my favourite smells. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very delightful, delicate, floral, citrusy note. Do you ever think of foods in colour terms? Like sometimes when I'm cooking... Mm-hmm.
Colours have flavours, right?
Colours have a certain flavour profile. So like reds and oranges are kind of bright and acidic and sometimes spicy, sometimes not, but definitely on the juicier side and are less likely to get mixed with my beige or white foods, which are creamy or thick or starchy or fatty. Mm. And then you've got green foods, which are really quite grassy and earthy.
Herbaceous.
And then that's it. No other foods.
blue foods, famously.
No. There's obviously... Yeah. Different foods, but like those are the kind of like flavor color profiles that I think of when I'm cooking.
Would you say there's a yellow from Moz? Is that not?
I think yellow probably falls into red and orange, but then there's also like spice and then, citrus flavors that are like turmeric and saffron. And
turmeric's
stuff.
Very earthy, and also polenta's yellow, and that's creamy.
It's not an exact science.
It's not an exact science.
I also have, when I'm cooking, say if I'm explaining what I'm making to Emmy, my partner, he'll be like, what are you making? I'm like, I'm making red flavour thing. And he's like, okay, I got it. I know roughly what.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And sometimes if I'm like debating what to cook with Tom and I need to think about like, do I want something that's like,
Green.
Do I want something that's red or do I want something that's like white? Beigey, but beigey, whitey, creamy.
That is true. I probably do it subconsciously. I've just never voiced it. That's interesting. Yeah.
And also everything has to have a bit of green because otherwise that's bad. But it just needs to be like a tiny bit and then it's healthy.
I think it's amazing that we associate oranges with such a distinct colour because A, their juice is yellow. If you go to the supermarket, check it out. Hold up a carrot next to the orange juice, it will be yellow. And also most oranges, especially that go into juice, they're green when they're ripe.
What?
Yeah. They have to be exposed to cold temperatures before they go from green to orange. Mm-hmm. So if you're growing oranges in a warm enough place, like Thailand, for instance, they just never go orange. And in places where you need them to go orange for the supermarket shelves, they actually degreen them. It's called degreening, where they put them in a big warehouse and expose them to ethylene gas. Friend of the podcast.
Yay! Ethylene! My girl!
Why have we asked our contractor we found on Angie.com to be our kid's legal guardian? Because he took such good care when redoing our basement that we knew we could trust him to care for our kids, all 8 of them, should something happen to us.
Are you my dad now?
No, sorry, I do basements.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
Any team that's tested AI tools for data has seen the pattern already. AI gives a different number than your BI tool. Metrics don't match across teams. And inevitably, users lose trust. It turns out, turning on AI is easy, but making it work on data is not. Hex AI was built to solve this. The key is nailing context. Hex is built to unify and curate your data context for agents. Data teams can observe, govern, and continuously improve every AI answer, so answers get smarter the more your team asks. The result? Your entire organization asks data questions in natural language and trusts the answers. Not because the AI got lucky, because it knows your business and its data. Because that's what an AI analytics platform should do. Join data teams from Cursor, Lovable, Ramp, AWS, and over 2,000 more at hex.ai.
Okay, let's talk about our final lunchbox today, and that's mine. Ooh. And true to form as a breastfeeding mum, I brought an alcoholic drink.
Hey.
This is an Aperol Spritz, everyone. Cheers.
Cheers.
Wow.
Cheers.
Chin chin. Chin chin. Lovely. Ooh. How delicious.
That's so good.
Mm. Smells like Christmas.
I think probably the most famous orange cocktail out there, would we agree?
I think the Campari Spritz is ultimately superior. I mean, there are many spritzes out there. I'm sure Rosie's about to tell us about some of them. Mm.
Spritz is definitely now a category of cocktail. Mm. It never used to be that popular in Britain, but on the continent, particularly in France, Italy, Spain, Germany, mm-hmm. a spritz is, you know, something that was very normal to drink. So I wanted to talk about Aperol today because, like Manu was saying, orange, the colour, is so evocative. Mm. And this, to me, is in the most recent 10, 15 years, has become this like extremely marketable coloured drink, right? And it's because Campari, who own the brand Aperol, invested loads in marketing and did an amazing job at turning this otherwise unknown drink in the UK and America into a cult cocktail.
Yeah.
I'll talk a bit about what Aperol is, how it came about, and also what spritzes are.
Sure.
But I should say other brands are available. But I actually do agree with you. I do love a Campari Spritz. I also love a Chinar Spritz. Which is made with an artichoke flavoured bitter.
Oh.
Not flavoured, but made from artichokes. Yeah. But so let's go back to 1815. let's go right back. After the collapse of the Napoleonic Empire, my favourite time, and there was, as I'm sure you're aware, a power vacuum in Europe at that time. Worth remembering that Italy is quite a new country, and in Italy's northern regions of Lombardy and the Veneto, they were not owned by Italy. They were fell to the Austrians.
Oh, yeah.
So Austrians typically were used to lighter wines. They were light because they're made in alpine areas.
And sorry, by light you mean colour or flavour?
Lighter in alcohol.
Mm. Oh, I see, right, yeah.
And Italians, not up for the old light alks. They were drinking the stronger stuff.
And
the Austrians had to get used to that, and they could not get used to that. They were like, we can't drink this. So they started adding water to their wines, and that was called Ein Spritzer. In German.
So you mix something with the wine.
Yeah. So it's to add a splash of water to wine. Later on in the 19th century, when the Italians gained their independence and the Austrians buggered off. That had sort of caught on a bit with the Italian population. It became a bit of a habit to water down stronger alcohols because they were very into their bitter aperitifs at this time. And it eventually became soda water that they started using. This was so carbonated water, not just still
so
water.
They were using flat water before.
They were using flat water before, but then the soda water became popular. Mm. Enter the Barbieri brothers of Padua. Luigi and Silvio, not very Italian names, I think you'll agree. No one knows they're Italian. They inherited their father's distillery and they decided they wanted to create a new liqueur that was lighter, like the local trend of having slightly lighter drinks, a bit similar to the aperitifs they'd encountered when they'd been holidaying in France. So that is when they made Aperol. And Aperol, the word, it's a riff on the French word aperitif, or aperitivo in Italian, which actually comes from the Latin word aperire, which means to open. And the idea with an aperitivo or an aperitif or whatever you want to call it, it's whetting your appetite. It's getting you ready for eating. It's a pre-dinner drink.
It's opening your digestive system.
It's like end of the day. You're about to go and have dinner, but you are going to enjoy a drink. And it's your aperitif. It's to make you hungry, right? So they spent 7 years perfecting this recipe of this lighter alcohol aperitif. It contains rhubarb, orange. So it isn't orange for nothing. It is has orange in it. And then other things like quinine, gentian. So a lot of the common...
What is gentian?
Gentian is a type of bark that's very strongly flavored. It's in basically in almost all of your like strong bitter liqueurs will probably have gentian in. So they also proposed that Aperol be used in a spritz.
Are we going to explain exactly what is in
the spritz? So in an Aperol spritz, it's a 3-2-1 ratio. Three parts Prosecco, Italian sparkling wine, if for those of you who are not familiar. Two parts Aperol, one part soda water. Plus ice, plus a characteristic orange segment. So, you know, you are seeing something that's very much orange vibes. It has, you know, expanded massively in Italy, along with all types of spritz, because people were like, you know what's actually really good before you go out for dinner is actually something that's a little bit lighter. And it is kind of just a perfect way to end a very hot day.
It's light in alcohol, but it's full of sugar, right? It's pretty heavy.
I feel like when has that been a problem?
It's not that much lighter in alcohol because you've got like concentrated alcohol, more alcohol, and then a little bit of water, and it's enormous. Like you are drinking a lot of wine.
Anyway, so essentially Aperol existed very much exclusively in Italy and in Austria and other parts for a long time.
Specifically Venice, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, Venice is a part of Italy where it became extremely popular. I just think it's very a very evocative coloured drink now. The Instagram age made Aperol Spritz what it is as well, because obviously it is so beautifully golden orange. And we started all posting pictures of our cheeky little aperitivo or, you know, our pre-drinks before our night out. And certainly in the UK, maybe not so much in Europe because I'm still so assimilated into their culture. Whereas for us, this is a little bit of a status symbol, right?
Yeah, and I don't think it would be a success in a can because of its visual effects. I've seen it bottled in Italy. And it's a clear glass bottle. Even if you had like tinted glass, it wouldn't really work because the whole point of it
is the colour. And actually what I haven't really spoken about it is like how culturally significant oranges are to Italy. And orange as a fruit is something that is just very, very Italian. And as is an aperitif. And I come across a quote which I really liked. So the author of a book called Spritz.
What's that about?
I don't know. Her name is Talia Biocchi, and she put that an Aperol Spritz isn't a luxury item, it's a cultural right.
Wow.
As is an orange, basically. They symbolize prosperity and vitality in Italian culture, and they have done for centuries, but particularly in Sicily, actually, where they are grown a lot. Sicily is actually Italy's largest growing orange region, and it's the second largest in Europe, following Valencia in Spain.
And actually globally, it ranks fourth.
Wow.
So it's big, big business over there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like, you'll see it. It's everywhere. Mm. Symbolically, it's on textiles, it's on ceramics, you know. And actually, I don't know if you knew this. Have you ever had an arancini?
Yes.
Arancini are the risotto rice balls in Sicily. Mm-hmm. Arancino means small orange.
Small orange. Arancia. Oh,
is that why it's round?
That's why it's round. And basically, they're sort of like a little good luck charm. Like, you know, you have your arancino, you've got your tiny orange, you're going to have a good day.
That's really nice.
Sicily also grows very specifically blood oranges, which are in season right now, guys. Ooh. As of recording today in early February, blood orange season is upon us. Mm-hmm. And you should all be getting some lovely blood oranges. Deep red orange. Mm-hmm. Kind of looks the same on the outside. Sometimes you will see there'll be like a red umber hue to the peel of the orange, but when you cut it inside, it's either completely dark red or it's kind of like speckled red. So there'll be a bit of beautiful orange and a bit of red.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It looks like blood. Due to the unique climate where they're grown in Sicily, very warm days, but typically quite cool nights.
Yes, because the cool nights are what makes peel go orange, because actually in hot countries, oranges stay green.
Yes,
like in Thailand,
exactly.
You rarely see an orange orange.
The chemical is,
anthocyanin.
Yes, thank you.
And these protect the fruit from cold weather, and they happen to show up quite dark and colourful.
Also, it's an antioxidant, so it's a good health benefit.
Yeah, and apparently they're very rare in citrus. Like, they're the things that make blueberries and citrus and beetroot, that lovely deep sort of blue tone.
Mm.
Which is quite strange to see in citrus. They're the only ones, I think.
Yeah. Well, blood oranges are harvested from right now, January, February till April, May. But blonde oranges, as they're often known as, are November until May. So quite a much longer season. They're much more widely available. That's the name for standard orange.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay, right.
Yeah, I like that, actually. Yeah, I was like, blonde. Yeah. I do want to just touch upon cooking with oranges, because
We should.
As the resident chef, I wanted to tell you, don't recommend.
Don't bother.
I'm joking. I obviously, oranges are a very useful ingredient in sweet baking.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I don't love them as much in savory cooking.
Okay. Yes.
It's definitely just my own personal taste than anything else. I actually find them just to be really dominant.
Uh-huh.
Mm. And I think also what I noted when I reflected upon it was, if it's a savory dish with orange in, I prefer the orange to be raw. I don't want it to be cooked, because as soon as it gets cooked, it gets those caramelly, marmalade-y notes that are very, very powerful. And when it's raw and used as a citrus, like a lemon or a lime, then it is way more mixable, and it's also just a lot less dominant.
Yeah. Okay, so I've had an orange ceviche.
Yeah.
So in like ceviche or something,
salad?
In a salad, like a fresh, the classic Sicilian salad, like an orange, olive, fennel salad.
How do you feel about stuffing birds with oranges? Because that's like a classic in my mum's kitchen.
I think that's probably fine stuffed, because it would just steam out its perfume and it would be very mellowed. But like, I would never ever order a duck à l'orange.
Really?
That for me would be a real turn off. I understand why people pair duck with oranges, because duck very fatty and a citrusy, orangey, sweet, juicy sauce is actually a really good complement to fatty meat. And you often see orange used with pork as well in Mexican cooking, for example. You have cochinita al pibil or carnitas, both use orange juice in those recipes, because pork is really fatty. But you won't see it very much with beef or with lamb, where they actually have quite bitter notes already as meat when they're cooked. So pairing it with another bitter thing
is not,
you know, even beef and lamb, less likely to come with lemon, like lemony flavors, aren't they?
I often glaze my ham with marmalade at Christmas time.
I like.
Yeah, we found one.
Now, a marmalade hat. Now, that's where you're talking my language. I just wanted to reference one particular orange cooking technique, which I think is really clever and useful. And if you can find recipes out there, there are tons. You should definitely try it. In Spain and in Italy, you will often see cakes made with whole boiled oranges. What you do is you boil your oranges till they're very, very soft, and then you blitz them up.
Without
cold,
peeling them.
Without peeling them. No, none of that. The entire thing goes in as part of the batter.
Wow.
And basically what you end up with is a really moist, really orangey, delicious cake. And like most cakes which involve fruit or vegetables in it, they end up just really, really moist.
Sure.
But particularly with the oranges, because they are so juicy, but they have all that pectin, which is a gelling agent. So they become this like, it's a very clever way of using a whole orange.
Mm-hmm.
And also it's a good way to make a cake dairy free, because you don't need to use butter in those recipes, because there's so much juicy fat. And also with fruit going into a cake batter, it's much better to use oil rather than butter. Anyway, yeah, those are some delicious cakes. And if I'd really thought about it, that's what I would have made. I did not.
Cheers.
Ooh. Cheers. That's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy.
You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes and questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
Rosie, do you have any parting recipes for us?
Well, yes, actually, I saw something my friend and food writer Alexina Anatole posted the other day, where she made vin d'orange, which is basically where you infuse vodka and rosé wine with a shitload of oranges and sugar for a month, and you end up with this delicious aperitif.
That sounds
homemade.
Great.
And you can find that on her Substack, Small Wins, or on her Instagram, Alexina Anatole.
That sounds banging.
Mm. We will leave you with this useful Spanish verb, anaranjear, which literally translates to orangicate, as in to pelt something with oranges. That's what I'm about to do to Jack. We will see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Jack Chambers, Manu Onrio, and me, Rosie McKean. It was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.
Why have we asked our contractor we found on Angie.com to be our kids' legal guardian? Because he took such good care when redoing our basement that we knew we could trust him to care for our kids, all 8 of them, should something happen to us.
Are you my dad now?
No, sorry, I do basements.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
It's 10:01 a.m. on a Monday, all at once. Your sales leader needs to know which deals are at risk. Your PM wants feature adoption by cohort. And your CFO needs one last graph for the board. Now your data team has to say no to somebody. Hex changes that. Ask any data question in plain English and get an analyst-grade response, all backed by your actual business context as defined by your data team. Start saying yes to more data questions at hex.ai.
This is Danielle Fishel.
And Ryder Strong from Pod Meets World.
When you have 5 and 7-year-old boys, I can promise you they love superheroes.
Oh, it never goes away. Indy is 11 years old and he's obsessed with comics, cartoons, video games, all of it.
Adler and Keaton both have Spider-Man costumes, and if anything says Marvel on it, they are in.
Same, which is why we love Lingo Kids. They have Marvel Spider-Man activities that are totally age appropriate.
And safe, made just for the little ones.
Plus, Disney's Moana, Frozen, Zootopia, all the characters your kids already love, and a few you're secretly hoping they'll get into.
I just load up the iPads with Lingo Kids before a trip, and with over 4,000 interactive activities, songs, and shows, it keeps their attention for hours.
Download Lingo Kids for free or go all in with Lingo Kids Plus for even more incredible content.
Choose the yearly plan and save up to 60%. Search Lingo Kids in the App Store or Google Play.
Lingo Kids, everything kids love.